The red light's on.
Oh, good.
Okay, well, welcome to the second go-round for this talk. And for the tape, I will say it's May 6th. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And it's Sunday, and it's 2007. And this is Kathleen Herron, and I am doing a talk about using the Dharma to deal with breast cancer and retinal detachments, but that could be any kind of health issues for anybody, or even any kind of challenges for anybody. Wouldn't even have to be health one. So I gave this talk a few weeks ago, and we just weren't able to get a good recording. So my teacher, Venerable Thupten Chodron from Srivasti Abbey, and Geshe Kelsang Damdul from Dharamsala Institute for Buddhist Dialectics, asked me to record this for the website. So thank you for being here so that we could do that. Okay, so I think it would be good if we just sat for a few minutes quietly. And Bobby, how do I... Is there a pause?
Press record again, and it will pause it.
Oh, just the same button.
Mm-hmm.
Going? Okay, welcome. I don't know you, Mr. Guy in the gold sweatshirt. Hi.
Oh, my name is Ken.
Ken?
Ken Palmer.
Okay, great. It's good to see you. I'm Kathleen. Welcome. I was just, one of the thoughts running through my head in that 5 minutes is that Geshe-la Kelsang Damdul said, if you sit for 5 minutes each day with intention to hold your mind to whatever object of virtue you want, could be compassion, could be mercy, love, and you do that with over and over, building a little habit, this 5 minutes, it will bring you great joy. And I think it's true. So it can be a quite simple thing. Although I have to say it took me 10 years to build a daily habit. Some of us have very excited minds. And some of us have very unexcited minds. So you have to figure out which way yours are. You'll kind of be a thinking mind or a la-la-la mind. And I tend to la-la-la. So you have to kind of pay attention and bring that out. So, where to start? Okay, well, I'll start just by saying what happened to me in very brief, and then what I want to do, I mean, what happened to me about my health, and then what I want to do is talk about the Four Noble Truths, because pretty much every Buddhist teaching, it makes sense to frame whatever you're doing in those, and I'll do that as a cursory overview, but hopefully it'll be helpful. And then I'm going to talk about the four directions my four different teachers gave me as I've gone through cancer and also a retinal detachment, which left me mostly blind in my left eye. Then I started another retinal detachment in my right eye, which left me with just a little foggy cloud there. And so many challenges all of a sudden that in fact weren't happening at this very time last year. At this time last year, I had just started finding out about my cancer, and the eyes hadn't happened. So there's a great teaching in change and impermanence there. We never know, right, when, boom, we're going to get a challenge or what we call a reward or whatever. And a lot of times we label it challenge, we label it reward, we label it good, bad, but it shifts. It shifts. The challenge turns into a gift, and many of you know this, these kind of things from your lives. The challenge turns into a gift. The reward turns into a terrible nightmare. You know, the wonderful, I have a friend who just came into a lot of money, and as he said, every time since then, his wife and him have just been having huge fights and struggles and difficulties over this money. And he said, you know, I always wished for a big inheritance, and now I have it, and we don't agree how to spend it, and the extended family gets involved, and he said it's really painful. So there you go, you know, you can't know. So anyway, I want to start the story by thanking friends who really tremendous kindness that showed up as soon as I knew I had any difficulty at all. I was showered with people coming to bring me food, to go to the hospital with me. It was like people wanted to do far more than I could even stand. And that has continued straight through. So once again, difficulty shows up and great kindness. And what I'm finding out by following the Dharma, the path in Buddhism, is that's always true. Kindness shows up in the hell realms. Kindness shows up in however you define those, mental or whatever. Kindness shows up in war zones. Kindness shows up in great tragedies. And also in things that we label as happy, difficulties are hidden right in there. So it's a very interesting kind of truth about the lives we're in, to look deeply at that. And one of the encouragements of Buddhism is don't get too caught of, oh, this is great, so I'll hold on, or, oh, this is terrible, and I'll push it away. It's really an effort, rather an intention of flowing, to just be with whatever it is, you know, see what happens. Be like a scientist is what I like to do. It's be like a scientist, like, oh, you know, I'm having these difficulties with my 31-year-old son. I wonder what will happen next, you know. Could turn. Sometimes it feels difficult. Can turn. The next day it's not, and then the next day it is. So I'm really grateful to my teachers, beyond gratitude to my teachers. I have a lot of heart for them, because I know how hard this would have been if I had not received their teachings. So, and it has been difficult, and it has been wonderful. So many times I've read many things by Buddhists and non-Buddhists that cancer is a gift, and a lot of times I thought, oh my gosh, how you know, Pollyanna, I mean, who could think that? And I really experienced that. So somewhere around April last year, I found a lump in my breast, and in a very quick series of things that just went like this, I discovered it was cancerous. And I was faced with either a very large lumpectomy or a mastectomy. So I chose a mastectomy partly in order to avoid radiation, which I talked to a number of doctors, and I've done a lot of alternative medical care throughout my life. And it was kind of like, the more you can not do radiation and chemo, the better. So I was 59 years old. I didn't mind living with one breast. I might have done something different if I was a different age or whatever. So no judgments about how anyone does this, but I decided to just have a mastectomy. I did that in July, and then about, oh my gosh, was it 3 weks after my mastectomy, I went blind in my left eye. The doctors say there's no connection, the medical doctors. Now, I believe, since everything is connected, certainly stress connection, but they're saying there's no medical connection, which I understand. There's no research that shows if you do this, then that would happen. Although, interestingly enough, anecdotally, I have heard from some other women who've gone through lumpectomies and mastectomies, and they've had retinal detachments. And just anecdotal, just two or three, and the nurse, when I went in for my retinal thing, told me that she had seen two or three. It could just be that's, you know, age-related, because these are generally age-related. Just a health tip, please get your mammograms, please do self-exams for the women, and for everyone, be watching for floaters and flashes in your eyes, like those little threads that go across, or little light flashes, especially when you get into your 40s. Go to an optometrist right away, have them looked at. Some of them are totally normal and some are not, and you kind of can't tell the difference until it can be a little too late. So how to get through such a thing? Well, I got very scared you know, I mean, the whole question of death comes right up to your face, right? You know, am I going to die from this? You know, what's it going to be like to go through this operation, live without a breast? What's it going to be like to live with my vision compromised? So very, very frightened. I was fortunate to have met Venerable Thubten Chodron like 10 or 11 years ago. So I had a daily practice. And I have to thank Bob Wilson for a big piece of that, because Bob and I, 2 to 3 times a week for, did we figure out 7 years?
At least 7 years.
For 7 years, 2 to 3 times a week, we have called each other on the telephone and meditated together. We met at a retreat at Cloud Mountain, and then found out we were both in Portland, and then found out we lived on opposite ends of town, and we were like, we don't want to drive and do another thing. And Bob had this wonderful idea of, let's just call on the phone, put the phone down, meditate a half hour, dedicate, and we're done. And because of the commitment to each other, we have kept that up. And I think, I know for me, it strengthened my practice. So thank you, Bobby, for your persistence. And so anyway, I had a pretty good practice. You know, I mean, I'm like anybody, you know, one day you can't get your mind on anything. It's hopping around like a flea. But you sit anyway. That's what I've learned. Sit anyway. It doesn't matter if your mind is seeming crazy, your mind seems calm, your mind seems wonderful, your mind seems terrible. It doesn't matter. Just sit down. Just sit down over and over and over. And I started with about 2 to 3 minutes standing in front of my altar, because that's all I could make myself do. And I found it torturous to do more. But started with that, then went to 5 minutes, then 15 minutes, then went backwards to 5 minutes, and on and on. Retreats have helped, going to retreats with my teachers. So that kind of tells the background. And why I wanted to do this talk is when I met with my teacher, Venerable Thubten Chodron, at Srivasti Abbey, and was telling her about how I had gone through this, she said, you need to write it down, you need to give a talk, because people need to hear, how do you end up happy? Which I'm happy. not every moment, but in general, how do you end up happy and not miserable, you know, after a mastectomy and compromised vision? Well, so let's start with, let me ask a question. How many of you know the Four Noble Truths? Just you can put your hand up, and if you don't, it's fine. Okay, because I didn't know quite how detailed to go, but that tells me a little bit. Okay, so the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, real guy, okay, person, rich prince, but was raised in a palace and given every kind of pleasure, every kind of protection. His father wanted him to be the next king, so he didn't want him to ever go outside the palace grounds and get enticed out in the world. So he and or hurt. So he kept him in the palace. But the Buddha, being a very intelligent, curious person, hit his, I don't know, what will we say? I don't know when he left the palace. Anybody know? 20s? He was young. Became curious, like we all do around that age, you know, go off to college, run away from home, whatever. And he also got that way. And he went out of the palace, and to his shock and dismay, he saw 4 pretty terrible things that he had been literally protected from. One was birth. He had never seen, but seeing poor people and seeing a woman doing birth and the whole pains and the terror of the baby and crying and all of that. He saw illness. He saw somebody very, very ill by the road, you know. And of course, he was seeing poverty also for the first time. And he saw death. And so birth, aging, sickness, and death, he saw them all. And it literally blew his mind. He was like, how could this happen? You know, it's like growing up in the suburbs, right? And then suddenly you find out racism's real, or sexism's real, or poverty's real, you know, and you're kind of going, I mean, that's how it happened. I didn't grow up in the suburbs, but when I got to college, you know, this kind of mind-opening thing of there's a whole world out there you don't know about, and you kind of start questioning what happened back there. How come I didn't know? And so he Long story short, he escaped from the palace. Many, many fights with his father. I was just reading a sutra about it, and it was very, very interesting how hard it was for him to leave home. His father really sent people to try and talk him out of it, and just like parents would do, like, you know, you'll be the king, it'll be wonderful, please don't go away and do this spiritual stuff, it's a waste of time, you don't know what you're doing. All of those common arguments. But he persisted and went away, and he studied many, many different paths while he was young, particularly asceticism, where he nearly starved himself to death trying to find the truth. You know, he went to extremes, extreme rich, then extreme poor, eating, the myth is a grain of rice a day. It's probably something more, but because I think he might have died, but who knows, maybe with his powerful mind he wouldn't. But at any rate, he got so sick and weak he couldn't do anything, so he said, this clearly isn't the way. You know, I mean, I can't even meditate anymore. So a woman was very kind to him on the road when he was almost dying that day from starvation and gave him a bowl of rice and milk, and it restored him. And he sat down under a Bodhi tree and he said, I'm not moving until I understand reality. I understand what I am. I understand what these conditions are. And I pierce through to complete enlightenment, which is complete understanding of what is it to be human, what is it to be in this body, what am I supposed to do, and that's what he was searching for. So he did. He had many, many mental tests, and he reached enlightenment on some certain day. I don't know how long it took, but he had many, many tests. And then he taught, and here's the first thing he taught. He taught the Four Noble Truths. First truth, suffering exists. You already know this, right? This is not hard to see. But he taught there are three levels of suffering. And I'm going, there are whole texts on each one of the sentences I'm saying. So I'm really condensing. Suffering exists. It's not something that's just, you know, because you're bad or you did it wrong or that person suffers, but this one doesn't. Everybody suffers. Everybody. It can be mental, it can be physical, it can be from too much, it can be from a lack. Everybody. So three types of suffering. The one I was at His Holiness the Dalai Lama this last week in San Francisco, and he had a very good word that I hadn't heard for the first type is evident suffering, the kind we see, or what I had heard before was gross suffering. You know, you hit your toe, cancer. You know, things that just plain hurt. You know, you're hungry, you're cold, you're tired, you're scared. You know, well, scared would be more mental. But gross, evident suffering. Everyone could see that, and we all agree. The second one is called the suffering of change, which when I heard about it was so good for me to hear because I had never known about this. The suffering of change is what we call pleasure. Why it's suffering is that inside of the pleasure is the end of the pleasure, and therefore the beginning of the suffering of not having it anymore. Hi, Judy, come in. So inside every lovely thing, every lovely relationship we start, our spouses, our friends, our hubbies, our wives, our kitty cats, our sons, our daughters, is the end of that relationship. And we know it and we ignore it. And we sort of suffer off of that. And because we don't want that end. If it's a good thing, we don't want that. As Geshe Lindup Sopa said, teaching this once, he said, well, let me explain it to you. He said, you're hungry, so you're suffering. So you start eating, and thus begins the suffering of eating. And you eat and eat and eat. And if you keep eating, what happens? It hurts, doesn't it? And then you stop eating because it hurts now. You're so full. Thus begins the suffering of hunger again. You get tired. You sit down. You're suffering from being tired. You sit down. Thus the suffering of sitting begins. Feels pleasurable for, you know, maybe even a half hour. But then we're like, you know. So you stand up. Then the suffering of standing begins. This is the hard story, folks. It gets better after this. So hang in there. But he's talking about the evident suffering. Then this is the kind of suffering of suffering. It's called suffering of suffering. Suffering of what we call pleasure. And we grab at it and we suffer worse because we don't want it to change, right? Then we really start suffering because anxiety comes. Now I want to hold on. The third kind of suffering is the all-pervasive suffering. And these are all Buddhist concepts. You might find them in other traditions, because I know some other traditions have different names for these. But Buddhism's what I've studied the closest. The third one is the suffering, the all-pervasive suffering of simply taking on a body that is going to be sick. How many here have never been sick? See, you ask that everywhere. Nobody can raise their hand. The suffering, it's just endemic in this body to get sick at time, endemic in the body to die, and endemic in the body to have to do those other things, feed it, sleep, and all that. Now, this isn't that our bodies are bad. They're wonderful mechanisms, and they're precious, and we need to take very good care of them and love them and, you know, treat ourselves and others well. But it's just a fact about our existence. This stuff just comes with. So that's the third kind. So again, the evident suffering. Ouch, I stubbed my toe. I had to have my breast cut off. Ouch, ouch, ouch. The suffering of change. It feels good. I'm eating ice cream. Those first four bites are so great. Even that first scoop. Oh, now I'm on the second scoop. I'll push it down anyway. And then walk out and then try to sleep, you know. the suffering that's built into what we call pleasure. And the third one is the all-pervasive suffering of we grasp. Buddhism says when we die, we grasp at the next body and we take it all on again, the sickness, the death, the everything. So we won't go into that part today so much. So that's the suffering, first noble truth. Second one, what causes it? Buddha looks, what causes the suffering? The mind. How do we know? Because everything is in the mind. There's so much evidence of this. You can have two people, pretty common type people, like let's say two women my age, me and another one, you know, pretty similar temperament. We can be sitting in the very same place and I could be thinking it's horrible and she can be thinking it's wonderful. The place is not different. Now, you've seen this over and over. You go to a party, someone said, that's the best party I was ever at. Someone else said, it was horrible. It was terrible. It's not the external conditions. They're the same. Or as Ram Dass, I heard him in a tape, he was talking about one time he was sitting in India and he had dysentery and he was sick as a dog and he was looking around and he was in a really dirty like bus station in India, just packed with bikers and everything. And he said to himself, I can't believe I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And he grew up with quite wealthy parents in the U.S., and he said, unbelievable. I used to sit in my parents' beautiful house and feel miserable and depressed and worthless and not important. Here I am in this bus station, sick as a dog, and all this poverty and need surrounding me, and I am happy. So we know it arises in the mind. When you think about how you feel about someone, where does it arise? I mean, just close your eyes for a minute and think, okay, someone you love. Just think of someone you love. Where is that love arising? It's not out there. It's not inside of their head. They may be loving you back, but your love, where is it arising? In your heart and mind. And by the way, the Tibetans point for mind here. They say the mind. It arises in your mind. Interesting. They might be onto something there. So the cause of suffering is our mind misperceives our interconnectedness, deep interconnectedness, deeper than we understand, deeper than even we understand as Earth Day kind of people, you know, really deeply interconnected to the point where there's really no difference you are me. I am you. There's really no, we're just in the costumes, you know, for a while. And if you think of time stretching infinitely both ways, it's really a short while. Even if you're like my mom and you live to 100 and a half, it's still a short while. We're just, you know, short while, we look different. But we make that very solid. And we make labels friend and enemy and stranger. And we then make those solid, and then we begin to act. I cut that one out. I talk bad about that one. I adore that one and try and cling to them. And all the suffering increases. Because what are the kind of things we do to grab on? You know, what are the kind of things we do to push away? You know, when we make enemies, we push away at the least, but at the worst, we kill them. When we grab on, you know, and pull in, that's not unconditional love. You know, we want this person, I want you to do this so I can love you, you know, and you didn't do that. Now I don't feel like I love you. Where's all that going on? Just here. So the idea is the cause is the mind. That's the good and the bad news. Good news is because we have some, it's ours. We can affect it, make some decisions. Okay. Third noble truth, there's a way out, okay? First two, all kinds of suffering and the cause of suffering. Third noble truth, there's a way out. It's the Dharma path. And there are thousands of kinds of paths, even in Buddhism and other very wonderful religions, the true Christianity, the true Judaic religions. And when I say true, I mean tradition, the long traditional ones, because some of the real new stuff is a little less grounded. I can't say much about it, but because of time, but just the ones that go back deep, you know, if you look deeply in all those religions, you'll find very common truths about this interconnectedness and about people practicing ethics. The ethics are the baseline. Practice ethics towards friend, family, stranger. No killing, no stealing, no lying, no unwise sexual behavior. Avoid intoxicants, you know. Why do we avoid intoxicants? Because they lead to killing, lying, stealing, and unwise sexual behavior. That's the reason. So there's a way out. On those little white sheets right there on that at the end, there are some websites. You'll get more teachings than you can ever digest in a lifetime. So about that. And the path I follow is Mahayana Tibetan Buddhism. So, it's the same path as the Dalai Lama follows. So that's the shorthand for it. And the fourth noble truth, complete peace is achievable. Complete, total, end of all suffering. Don't have to have one iota of suffering in our minds anymore. We don't have to. It's possible. And how do we know that? Well, the Buddha did it, and I myself have met at least five teachers now over the 11 years where I believe they're either there or so close to there that you can feel it from them. They just don't get unhappy much, if at all. And I've seen a few of them in some pretty extreme circumstances, and they still don't get unhappy. In fact, they say that for a bodhisattva path, you like difficulties. Why would we want that? Why would a person welcome difficulties? Really, I'm asking. Yeah?
You get to work with that mind and see how it responds with it, and how you can use the teachings to provide perspective at that moment.
Yeah.
Reinterpret it.
Yeah. And
another thing.
Yeah, John.
I think it helps us to be more connected and compassionate to all the other people who are suffering. Oh, I experienced that. Now I'm more clear about how other people feel, and I can have that much more compassion and love for those people who are experiencing that.
Yeah, so the heart gets bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The heart gets bigger through the suffering. And you know yourselves, when you meet people who have suffered a lot, there's kind of a softness, there's kind of an openness. they are the kind of people will come up and tell them like amazing things about their suffering, and they won't go, oh my God, you know, they just go, they have some space to listen, like, yeah, with heart, you know. As one of my teachers has said, I can't remember who, I think it was Venerable Thupten Children who first said it. She said, we need to thank our so-called enemies or difficult people because they are the ones that teach us patience. Our friends won't ever teach us patience. You know, they're too nice, you know. But close by people that become difficult, you know, or strangers or the people whose dog poops on the lawn, you know, patience and skills also. How do you solve that without your anger and a confrontation and more suffering occurring? So how did I get there? I don't know. But this total peace, often referred to as nirvana, is not a place. It's a mental state. Okay. All of this, samsara, is this level in Buddhist philosophy. And nirvana is the end of this. But what it's the end of is the mind of suffering, the end of the mind that suffers. The house isn't going to disappear. I used to think nirvana was like get on a cloud or something. The house isn't going to disappear. The difficult people aren't going to disappear. You're just not going to see them as difficult anymore. They're just going to, you're going to be so happy. Bodhisattvas are so happy when they see someone difficult. So-called, they're like, great, a problem. Now I get to do my spiritual practice. Otherwise, you just sail through like, you know, don't learn anything. Okay, wow, that was the Four Noble Truths. Okay, now, I got four instructions from my teachers when I got the cancer. And the first one came. I don't know what order they came in, actually. But one of the most important, Venerable Thupten Children, was here from Srivasti Abbey, which is over by Spokane, Washington. And she was here visiting right before my surgery, and I was driving her to the airport. And I asked her, you know, what can you tell me how to get through this? And, of course, by then, it was like 2 days before my surgery. My anxiety was about here, right, or maybe up to the ceiling. I had not been in a hospital since I was a kid, and I had some pretty serious surgeries when I was a kid, and I did not want to go back there, even though I was pretty sure it had changed and gotten a lot better since the mid-1950s. But I still didn't want to go back there. And she just turned to me, and she said, completely clear, it just came so wonderfully, and boom, she said, your job in the hospital is to be kind to everyone you meet, period. So think what that does. It got me off of me. It got me off of me totally and got me onto the overworked nurses, overworked doctors, overworked anesthesiologists, overworked surgery nurses. And I took it very seriously. I went in that hospital and I said to myself, I'm having surgery today, but that's kind of a side thing. What's really happening is I'm here to be in this hospital to be kind to every single person I see. And that's what I did. And my stay in the hospital was amazing. I can only tell you. And one thing I want to do is thank Judy, because one thing you told me was I could wear earphones, and I always pass that along, that you can wear earphones during your surgery, and if your doctor gives you permission, and while you're under anesthesia, they say you're more very much suggestible, and so whatever on those is going in. So I took a mantra, a healing mantra from my teacher, and a lecture from her about the particular, it's called the Blue Medicine Buddha, the Healing Buddha, and I just put it on continual tape, and I played it all the way through from the moment they were prepping me all the way out to the recovery room. And I asked the anesthesiologist, he said I had to take it off for a few minutes to hear some directions, and he said he put it back on. Sure enough, when I got to the recovery room and came to with the lovely, kind nurse calling my name, I just saw blue medicine Buddhas everywhere. It had gone in my head. You know, and I don't mean they were an apparition. I mean, it was the way, like if I say pizza to you right now, you can picture a pizza. So I had that just Blue Medicine Buddha going in my head. So when I opened my eyes, I felt like Blue Medicine Buddhas. The other funny thing about it was that all the surgical team wore these blue outfits. And they had blue, you know, everything they had on was deep blue. And that was the blue. And so I even told them, I said, I'm listening to Blue Medicine Buddha and you are all dressed in blue. This is great. And they just cracked up. So I'm positive that helped very much. And then Bob and some other friends came over that very night because I didn't want to miss my evening practices. I can barely remember. I was so drugged up. But I know we did my usual practices, my commitments together. Mostly you guys did them because I was floating somewhere. But, you know, just setting up some things ahead of time. So, but the main thing was she said, be kind. Be kind. And it pulled me right out of my self-centered fear. The anxiety was up to the sky and it went way down. And I just, you know, it wasn't perfect. I mean, there were some painful things and I didn't like the morphine and all of that. But by and large, no problems. And that was the second instruction, was an instruction I got years ago at a retreat at Cloud Mountain Center. And that instruction is from an incredible book called Transforming Problems into Happiness. And that's a book by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And I just stumbled on the book, opened it up, and the first sentence I just sat and thought, either this guy is a genius or he's crazy as a loon. Because the first sentence says something like, when you have a problem, think to yourself, this is not a problem. I thought, what could that do? I mean, if your car is broken down, if you're sick, if your kid is sick, what good would that do? Then I sat there with it and I thought, well, what does it do? If you think of that, this is not a problem. If it's not a problem, then what is it? So it opens a space, doesn't it? A space gets open. Mm-hmm. What is it? It's not a problem. Then what is it? Suddenly you get to just explore it. Well, what is it? I don't know. Maybe it's a moment, you know, you get a flat tire. It's a moment to just stop. Okay. You know, all right. You know, you get cancer. If it's not a problem, then what is it? Can be a lot of other things. For me, it's been a great teacher. Oh, and I want to share one of the main teachings I've gotten is the cancer challenged my arrogance. Now, what arrogance? The arrogance that said, I take care of sick people. I never get sick. And you feel that one-upness? I'm a person who stays well and takes care of sick people. I'm not the one who needs and gets weak. And so, boom, all of a sudden, I not only wasn't that, but I was somebody with a life-threatening disease. And now with a visual disability, which has been quite humbling. Not humiliating, but humbling. Very different. In a good way, softened me, which I needed. Because I tend to rise up and take care of everybody and then get impatient and then why didn't they be grateful and la 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 and I'm better than them and na 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 na, you know, all those crazy things just our minds are. So those were the first two instructions. Be kind to everyone you meet, especially in the hospital. And the key for me was she said, your job is, because she knew me. She knew if she gave me a job, I was going to do the job. So she made it a job. Because she's seen me. If I'll give her a job, she'll do it. So it was good. Then this is not a problem. So again, we're back to the mind labeling. And then the third instruction came from Yongsi Rinpoche, who's here in Portland at my Atripa Center. And again, the website's on that sheet there. You can pick one of those up. And he said, when I met with him for 2 minutes one day and told him what was going on, he said, be gentle with yourself and do taking and giving meditation. And the taking and giving meditation, we'll see if we have any time left after questions to just maybe do 5 minutes of it. But it's a very deep, beautiful compassion practice in which we do the opposite of what we usually do in life. Everything in Buddhism is about training the mind. And so this one's a deep mind training. In real life, what we want to do, well, we don't want to, but we just find ourselves doing this. We take everything that's good for ourselves, don't we? I mean, we try and pretend we're nice and stuff, but, you know, really, we like to take everything good for ourselves and kind of give the other stuff to someone else. We want to be happy and comfortable and, you know. So it's not because we're bad. This is just how our minds work, our little greedy, self-centered mind. I'm the middle of the universe, so of course I should have the best, you know, and you should have something nice, but not the best. I want you happy too, but I really, really want me happy, you know. So taking and giving challenges that totally. It sets the ego up and it challenges it. Now, when I'm saying ego, there's healthy ego, and we all need that. We're not trying to deconstruct a good, healthy sense of self where you take good care of yourself. But it's this other ego that's that would be mean and cruel and disregarding of people, and that causes the difficulties in the world, you know. And we've all gotten involved in it, you know. It's the part that hurts other people, you know. So what this taking and giving does is it completely flips it. So you sit, you imagine someone you, well, actually they say to start with yourself, yourself in the future, let's say, who's going to still get sick sometimes, still going to die, body's going to deteriorate. Doesn't matter whether you're young or old, it's going to happen. So you think of that. Maybe all other kinds of difficulties are going to happen. You're going to lose your friends. My mother, she's 100, and she said one of the hardest things is I have to make new friends all the time. You know, she says all my 70, 80, 90-year-old friends are dead and gone. All of her sibs are gone. Her parents are gone, of course. You know, that's a very sad thing. You know, can you imagine everyone that you've ever been friends with gone off the earth? Your spouse, you know, it's very difficult. So that kind of suffering, the loss of loved ones. And we don't know what's going to happen environmentally, you know. Just so you think of all those sufferings, you have yourself there. And what we usually do is say, well, okay, just keep that away from me. I want to be safe and sound. But instead, with this meditation, what you do is you actually breathe in that suffering and you imagine it like black smoke going into your nose. You feel the aversion to it. You don't want it. But it melts in your heart, and it melts the hard part, the hard-heartedness. And it becomes very soft, and then light opens, and you send that out. So you send everything good out, and you take everything difficult in. And you do this first with yourself. You can do it with yourself as a child. If you had hard times as a child, I've done that, taken on my suffering as a child again and really wish that little girl to be completely happy and really wanting to take it from her and give her all safety and, you know, and no poverty, and no abuse, and just have a lovely place to grow up in. And you just do that, and soon what it does is break down the barriers. You, at some point, there's no other and no you, and you're both just held in a beautiful, compassionate light. So that's what Tonglen does. It's taking and giving. Tonglen is the Tibetan word. So he said, do that about cancer. Just take on all the cancer everywhere. Well, one thing that was really interesting was my neighbor had been diagnosed with a much more aggressive breast cancer about 3 months before me. So that became one of my main practices, because especially because she has children at home, and I was working on, you know, let me have that and her be free of it. And, you know, and then of course it would just melt away and we'd both be free. What we'd be free of is any fear or any anything, you know, just held in a, just disappeared in the light, in essence. So that's what you do. If you get a cold, you take on all the colds in the world. You can do this for 2 minutes, you know, just see. And you can, and really feel the aversion rise, because it shouldn't be an easy practice. If it is easy, the ego is not being challenged. So that was one. That was the other one. And then the final one, because I want to give us time for questions, and it's about 5:25, and we'll end at 6. But if you need to go earlier, you know. But the final one was from Geshe Kelsang Damduo, who is just about, I don't know what, he's just full of light and love. He's Tibetan, and he works in Dharamsala, and he helps run an institute that trains the young monks in all the texts, and there are thousands and thousands of texts. So he's a Geshe-la, which is equivalent to a doctorate in Buddhist studies, although in our doctorates we take, what, 3 to 5 years? They take 20 years of studying. So Geshe-la has this rare thing of combining this incredible intellect with this big, big warm heart. Big warm heart, and another rare thing, a Tibetan monk Geshe who has very good English. So we've been able to sit with him, and I think John has too. I don't know who all has here, but have some wonderful teachings from him. Have you been with him? He'll be here in June, I think. So so anyway, Geshe-la said to me. He got very firm with me, and I haven't seen him get fierce. He's usually very softy and like this. And I went in and talked with him. This was in between the cancer and the eye that he came. And I had a lot more fear after the cancer and the eye then blew out. I just got really, it just knocked me off. It was like, I got through the cancer. I think I'm okay. And then boom, you can't see, you know. And I was really shaky when he was here. And I went to see him. And he said to me very fiercely when I left, he did some medicine Buddha prayers and gave me a little medicine, blessed my medicine Buddha to take into the surgery with me. And then he said, when I was leaving, he said very fiercely, never think of this as anything else but purification. Never. And I just felt pulled together. I just felt like reconstituted and strong from him saying that. And I thought a lot about that. And what he was trying to do is keep me from going in the ditch of victimization and fear again, you know, the anxiety. He said, no, it's a spiritual thing happening. This is a spiritual thing happening. And it's a good thing. And you're getting through it. And you can just keep going, because you can just say, I'm being purified, I'm purifying, I'm purifying. And it completely, just like Venerable's direction, pulled me up out of this ditch of that I was slipping into, of just fear and anxiety, and that's, there's the self-centered, I have to protect myself, and I can't trust anyone, and all of those things that our minds go to when we're frightened. So that's them. That's what happened. And I've used them, and I've done them as best as I could, not as much as I ought to and hope to, but it has made me have a happier, calmer mind while I've been through this. And many who've been around me could tell you that that's true. You know, a lot of you here in the room. So it doesn't mean I don't have my depressed days or my sad days. Of course I do. But they're, if anyone had told me you're going to have cancer and go blind in your left eye and you're going to feel as good as I'm feeling, I would have said, that's not possible. So the only possible for me through the Dharma, and then also I do therapy and counseling stuff, but really this is the baseline for me. So I hope that's helpful. And what kind of questions or stories that people want to share? I mean, any, or thoughts that you have as you listen to this.
Well, I really appreciated your reminder of being humble and not feeling separate, or because in my experience, I can find myself giving out a lot of support to others, and I'm almost never sick. So you mentioned that kind of arrogance to just remember that it is a gift, and there's no me really or other, that it's a privilege to be able to support in what other way in the journey that I can, and to keep that humbly aware and not arrogant or, you know, like, ugh, I feel like, and to keep that, just that awareness is really important.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Ken MacLeod, who's another teacher I've sat with, who has a wonderful book called Wake Up to Your Life, he talks about, one time I was with him and he talked about, how did that go? The tyranny of compassion. And I thought, what could he be talking about? Compassion's a good thing, right? And he said, yes, it is. Compassion that is motivated by the wish to end suffering for every being. But some compassion without wisdom, can get motivated by the self-centeredness, and then it turns into that martyr complex thing, you know, where you're mad now. You gave and gave and you're mad. You know, I'm mad at them. They didn't change. I gave and they weren't grateful, and I gave and they didn't treat me right, and That's the compassion that can turn into tyranny, you know? So it was an interesting thing about that. You know, we have to even watch these beautiful values and tools can, self-centeredness can grab them and pull it in and say, no, I'm making this mine, you know? And the arrogance grows. And then you have to get whapped so that the arrogance goes down. Or some of us just get nudged, but for me, it would. Yeah.
At times when you're feeling, have felt arrogance, do you ever look at it very non-judgmentally and say, oh, I'm just like everyone else in the world who experiences arrogance, and actually take that in a positive way.
Nice.
You know, and be kind to the arrogance and say, oh, now I can really connect with all of the other arrogance and everyone else.
That's very nice.
And then you stumble on that.
I haven't, but that's a great one. That's like taking it another step, because the arrogance is just a form of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is just a form of suffering. So we want to hold it as a form of suffering, not as something bad. Yeah, so thank you. That's great. I haven't done that. I'll do it. I'll try it. Anybody else? Thoughts? Bobby?
One thing on your transforming challenges into happiness. I don't know about for you, but this last 5 months for me has been immensely challenging. Just everyone with illnesses and difficulties and work, and it's just, so it's really to use a burning up karma, as you were sharing, that's what's really, really happening. I've tried overall really to practice with everything I know, be kind to me and gentle, and not practice all my old addictions, anything. And for me, it's alcohol, food, drugs, whatever. And just really be present with the difficulty. Use Buddhist practice, but as you mentioned, use counseling and some other things to really normalize the immense grief I feel, and anger and sadness over the things that happen. That is a natural reaction to the immense difficulties, and to arise when it brings up in me a deep hatred of life and frustration and a strong desire to run away from life and shut down my heart.
Yeah.
To be present with that.
Yeah.
And know I'm burning up a lot of karma, purifying. My old reactions would be to run away into substances and completely go off kilter. So this has been a really fertilizing growth opportunity during this time. And it reminds me to pull that book out again, which I look at for a while and put away, because its message is kind of right up front. Can't deny what it's saying, transform problems into happiness.
Yeah. Instead of adding on by the addictions or the addictive
shutting
behavior.
Down my heart and life, because a part of me... I don't like suffering.
That's good. We don't want to like it.
Deep aversion to any form of suffering.
Yeah, right. All four forms.
Oh, yeah. I've gone to school,
all four forms.
Punch him or her in the nose, even whether there is or not.
Yeah.
So brought up in me the primal rage distrust. So it's an interesting, just to see, wow.
Well, you know,
that was still there.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that I do about emotions is a helpful direction, actually, is from Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a Theravadan. Is he Theravadan? Zen. 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 Excuse me, out of Vietnam, Zen. And what he says, and it's very helpful, when I start having feelings, lots of emotions, is to remember those are just a river going through. Don't even grab the emotions and make them too solid, like I'm so angry or I'm so this. Don't identify too much with them, you know, because there's the river of body. It's changing all the time. I mean, even science says, what, every 7 years we're completely, all the cells have changed again. And every day they're sloughing off, you know. So the slow river of body, then the quick river of mind, can't even keep a thought. It's boom, 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 boom. And the quick river of emotions and the quick river of sensations, you know, my bum on the chair, the legs crossed, the air cool, warm. Always changing, all these always changing. So there, we don't have to grab any of this. We can just enjoy, be in it, appreciate it, practice the compassion and love, and just have a great old time. You know? Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of teachings, now most of my work is with young children, you know, working in childcare, and often there's opportunities for great suffering in terms of the children trying to test and do things to try to get responses, and or when I see them treating each other in unkind ways, I find my tendency as of late has been, I mean, for years now, but it's getting stronger lately, has been just a very physical thing of having a soft, peaceful smile during those times. Before I got to that point, what I would tend to do is have more of a tense smile that was more like this.
Yeah.
Oh, hi. Well, let's see, you know. But then that became more of a kind of just a very soft, gentle smile that would get me in the right place to deal with it in a compassionate, kind way.
Yeah.
And it is a practice. Good. Because I find the more I do that, the more natural it becomes. But and to take away from the arrogance of, I'm sure that there's always going to be times where that, you know, that doesn't happen, and where I'll even go, hey, enough already. Let's, you know, and I'm
yeah.
going,
yeah.
I bet there's a better way of dealing with that. And I'm going, I am human, and, you know, and I am experiencing what many parents experience on a daily basis, and childcare workers and so on, spouses,
yeah.
and
yeah.
all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And but it's interesting, you know, it's life, every moment of life is an opportunity for practice.
Yeah.
And I feel really fortunate to be with young children who give me infinite opportunities, you know, to practice
yeah.
kindness and all kinds mm-hmm. of things.
Great.
Yeah.
I was really struck by the piece, because I heard this before, about the second type of suffering.
Mm.
And since I've heard that, I've noticed specifically with food and like sweets and that yearning to continue.
Yeah.
With that.
As soon as we see it, we want it. Hold it, don't we?
Yeah.
Make it last. And there's the suffering. We're already not enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like built into it. That I'm very intrigued by that one too, because it's not the suffering we know the most out here in the world, because we call it pleasure. But Venerable says, the moment the attachment arises, whether you notice it or not, the suffering's already there. The moment we try and grab that taste of ice cream, and just, can it all taste as good as the first bite? You know? Why does it make my headache? You know, the third bite makes my headache. You know, and you know, it's really interesting. The whole culture calls it pleasure.
Well, it's slowed me down a lot. Like, it's really slowed me down with making that first bite enough to a certain degree. Not that I only have one bite of ice cream, but slowing down to really be with more with what is pleasurable in that moment, because it's not going to last.
Yeah. And she said one thing that's coming to my mind, a very clear instruction she gave us once is, the next time you eat something you think is delicious, while you sit with it, say, why do I call this pleasure? Just have it, you know, chocolate in your mouth or ice cream. Just investigate, why do I call this pleasure? And then the next time that something difficult is happening, say, why do I call this pain? And you start really working with the mind about labeling things and how that labeling adds to the experience rather than the direct experience. In other words, it pulls us away from the direct experience, I want to say. We don't even know what the direct experience is. When I went on a 3-month retreat at the Abbey 2 winters ago, one of the most interesting things to me, and I just reread my journal not too long ago, was, and it showed up in the journal, was about 3 weeks into the retreat, I said, because everything has slowed down in silence and, you know, we're meditating 8 hours a day, I said, I figured out I don't know what is rational about food. I have no idea how much is enough, because I finally got enough quiet and enough healthy food to just listen to my body without, you know, all the ads screaming at you and all the sugar and everything out there. And I went, oh my gosh, I don't know how much my body needs. I actually have never, I'm like 57 years old, and I don't know what rational eating is. And it was fantastic to hit that moment and say, wow, so now, because we ate in silence, and now I get to experiment. Oh, that was a little too much. Oh, that wasn't enough because I'm hungry. Oh, that was just right, you know. And it was very different than what my mind was telling me, you know. It was just fascinating. So that same thing, to just get slowed down enough to pay attention to what's really going on, because this culture we're multitasking and not doing any of them very well. And, you know, shooting this off and that off and emails and phones and actually causing quite a bit of suffering by going quickly, not just our own, but others. But it was so lovely to just get slow enough to go, I wonder what my body actually needs here, you know? You know, it's hard to figure it out because we're pulled away all the time from what's really going on. So that's good. You're feeling that, noticing that.
And sleep too.
Yeah, sleep is the same thing. And all of it, exercise, how much movies do we need? How much TV do we need? You know, how much meditation do we need? All of those things come up. How much time with friends and family do we need? We don't even know because we're just buffeted around by all this desire and the desire realm of U.S. consumerism just buffets us constantly. Okay, so one more thought or question, and then how about if we do like a few minutes of Tonglen, like a 5-minute? You want to try it out? Any other additions or subtractions or multiplications?
Just thank you for your gift of sharing your experience with us.
Oh, yeah, of course.
All garbanzo king and human beings. Benefit everywhere.
Yes, every bean.
Every bean.
Every bean and non-bean.
Yes.
Okay, so I'll lead a little Tonglen here, the way I've learned it through Venerable. And do we have a friend coming? And so again, make yourself comfortable. And as Geshe-la says, I always like this little shorthand. There's two shorthand ones I use for first sitting down and trying to relax. And Geshe-la just says, relax your body, relax your mind, relax your emotions. And the second one I like to use is Ken MacLeod says, body like a mountain, mind like the sky, and breath like the breeze. So you just let them be. Don't try and be them, but just let them be in the way that nature is in that way. Mostly we try too hard. Yongsi Rinpoche says about Westerners, they try too hard. Don't try. Bless you. So if you've done this practice before, then just go ahead and choose a friend, enemy, stranger, or yourself. If you're new to it, it's a good idea to choose yourself, either as a young person, past suffering you've had. You might think of your teenage times or young times. Or you can also choose yourself as you age and face difficulties. That's my little Tashi. Yeah. So get a clear picture of yourself sitting there, or the being you've chosen. As we get more proficient, we can choose an enemy, you know, someone that you feel aversion towards. But don't start with that, okay? But that's where you want to work up to, is a stranger and enemy. Start with yourself or someone you're very, very fond of. It'll make the practice softer. And the next step is to look deeply at that person's suffering. So you need to get a feel for it. And you can notice your aversion in letting it in. Like, I start feeling aversion right away. Like, I don't want to get too close to it. But just be brave. Keep going towards it. Towards sharing it with them. If it's someone extremely lonely, really feeling that loneliness with them. And as you begin to feel that, then breathe it in as a dark smoke. Just keeping your breath normal, but when you're breathing in, imagine it's that suffering coming into your heart through your nostrils. When it reaches the heart, you can use several images. Some use a lightning bolt, that it actually bursts, breaks like a lightning bolt hitting the self-grasping, which is like a hard meteorite thing at your heart. Or you can have it much gentler. It just shines a light and softens and softens and softens. And your heart is just filled with light from taking that on. And then you breathe that light out with all the kind of good things. Like, I'm working with someone on loneliness, deep loneliness. I'm taking it in to my heart, and then I'm breathing out the light of having many happy friends, close family members, and I'm actually thinking of giving those away, my friends, my family, giving them to that person for their happiness. So just do this for a little while and notice what happens for you. One thing I notice is that they become happy. I've started to notice that. They become happy as they receive these things. And then I notice that happiness makes me happy, even though I started with aversion. And if you can or you want to, you don't have to do this next step. You can take it one little bit further by remembering that you and they are so interconnected, so totally interconnected. They're really not different from you at all. So it feels like all the same happiness and the same suffering. Yours and theirs. And one small trick I've tried that someone told me is think, label them as me and me as them. So there I am. If you're using a different person, that's me. Okay, so that's just a little flavor of it. And you can see how just having this thought, you don't need to sit and meditate, but you're walking along the street, you see a homeless person, may I take that suffering? May they have my house. You know, you see a kitty cat, may they be a happy human being next time, may I be a kitty. You know, just whatever, you know, because the point really is, it's a mind training. It's not what's happening for them. It's us. It's a training in compassion. Are you okay with cats? He likes you. This is his plaything. He bites so he doesn't break skin. But you don't. You
he
can.
Doesn't.
No, he hasn't. He's very wild right now. He's like 7 months. He's a teenage kitty. He's a teenage kitty. So, any experiences you had with that? Any thoughts people want to share? Don't need to, but, you know, it's something you can do quick and easy. You can enrich it by using someone you feel you're having difficulty with. I like to do that, you know, whoever I'm feeling like towards. Sit down and just, you know, may I take that suffering and may you be free from it. Someone who has a shared health problem.
I have trouble visualizing myself
in
the future.
Yeah.
I couldn't get a picture, but then I pictured my mom. At
oh,
least,
good.
You know, that's a image of what I may look like. And so that felt a lot more real to be able to take in her suffering.
Yeah.
Which in mine may look the same.
Yeah. So you got a feel for it then of aging. I'm going to age and it's going to be suffering and I take it in and wish this one, you know, happiness while they age or wish them to be healthy or give away my vitality right now as a youth. You know? Yeah. It's quite powerful. Mm-hmm. Family members are terrific. Toshi, what are you doing to Kelly Joy?
We have this kind of relationship.
No, Kelly Joy takes care of him, so he's like, boy, he's so glad to see you. I want to eat you. And then see how he licks you? If you hold the hand still, he'll start licking.
Yes.
He's so happy to see you. Okay, any other thoughts? Yeah.
Well, even as a guest with a tornado in Kansas, thinking of that when you see those kind of images and experiences where people's lives, a whole complete town, completely destroyed. Taking in from them all the immense suffering and shock and death and all the complete disintegration of everything they know. And then as you walk around Portland, it's just such an amazingly gorgeous town.
Our beautiful neighborhoods.
And sending us all, everything that is right about this town and all the harmony and kindness of everyone here to them also. So I try to use that.
Yeah.
I'll even have a globe or hold a globe and kiss the globe at different parts on the globe as our earth experiences Aoi's and all the family, our human family in different countries do that. It's a way to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's terrific, and it can become very habitual. Mm-hmm. Like I know, listening to the newspaper when my mind is present, I go, oh, you know, take that in and send it out. Or just say a healing medicine Buddha, you know, may that be healed. May you be happy. It can be that quick. May you be happy. May you have a good life. And particularly for the perpetrators of crimes, that's who we forget. Mm-hmm. Venerable is always saying, particularly for the perpetrators, we often feel warm-hearted towards the victims, and we don't feel that towards the perpetrators, and often they need the prayers much more. So may they be relieved from that suffering, that mind, that thought, they need to kill somebody, or they need to do this and that. May they be relieved from it. May it never happen again. May they go to a better state of mind, and just automatically doing that, you know, it's just, it's for us, you know, it's for our minds. We're doing it for our minds. Of course, it puts more peace in the world than being mad or upset, but okay, so let's do a quick dedication, okay? Just if you can think about this in any way you want, but let's dedicate the effort that we brought to come here today, that we spent this kind of time instead of some other kind of time. Let's dedicate all the goodness of that, the Buddhists call it merit, to the end of the suffering of every single being with nobody left out. Our so-called worst enemies, strangers, family, and friends. May they all be happy, and may we dedicate this effort towards that happiness. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yay, whoopee, as Bobby says.